It is time for our fourth installment of Full Bio. All this week, we're discussing the massive biography, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, by Professor David Blight. It won the Pulitzer in 2018 and has just been released in paperback. Today, we discuss Frederick Douglass, the politician. He was embraced by the Republican Party and campaigned for every president post-Civil War. That's not to say he always agreed with their policies. For example, early on, Douglass was a critic of Abraham Lincoln. Among his concerns were Lincoln that he did not initially support black soldiers fighting in the Civil War. And once they did fight, including two of Douglass's sons, the administration paid black soldiers half of what white soldiers were being paid. Also, Lincoln was not an abolitionist. He was most concerned with keeping the Union together. And at the end, until the end of Douglass's career, ending slavery and promoting equal rights and making sure black Americans had a voice in politics, that was his goal. Here's a bit of one of the last speeches that Douglass ever gave. In 1894, he spoke about suffrage, as states throughout the South were imposing literacy tests with the aim of preventing black people from voting. Here's actor Fred Morsell.
I have sometimes thought that the American people are too great to be small, too just and magnanimous to oppress the weak, too brave to yield up the right to the strong, and too grateful for public services ever to forget them or to forget to reward them. I have fondly hoped that this estimate of American character would soon cease to be contradicted or put in doubt. But events have made me doubtful. The favor with which this proposition of disenfranchisement has been received by public men, white and black, by Republicans as well as Democrats, has shaken my faith in the nobility of this nation. It does away with that noble and just idea of Abraham Lincoln that our government should be a government of the people, by the people, for the people, and for all the people. I would not make suffrage more exclusive, but more inclusive. I would not have it embrace only the elite, but I would have it include the lowly. I would not only include the men, but would gladly include the women. And make our government in reality, as in name, a government by the people, of the people, and for the whole people.
Frederick Douglass became a fixture in D.C., but he was now an elder and found himself at odds very publicly with some of the emerging black leaders of the time, such as John Mercer Langston, one of the first African-Americans to hold elective office in the States, and Richard T. Greener, dean of Howard Law School and the first black graduate of Harvard. Today's Full Bio conversation with David Blight, Frederick Douglass, and politics. I'd like to talk about Frederick Douglass and politics. Do you consider him a political figure leading up to and during the Civil War?
Oh, yes. He's an enormously political figure. Politics, though, like for all of us, for Douglass, was a learned instinct. As we said earlier, he came of age as a Garrisonian abolitionist. He was supposed to denounce politics and denounce voting. Well, he's not doing that any longer by the early 1850s, and Douglass, in the course of the 1850s in particular, learned to a degree the craft of politics. But this is politics from outside of political circles, outside of political parties, by and large, and certainly outside of the government. But Douglass became, in the 1850s, in his newspaper, an extraordinarily astute analyst of American politics, and especially of the question of slavery in American politics. He desperately wanted to wield influence if he could. The trouble is, he couldn't, by and large. He was running a newspaper and up in Rochester, New York. He was on the circuit giving lectures and speeches, but he was never inside any particular political body. However, with the Civil War, and its revolutionary transformations, he begins to get inside the politics of the Republican Party. Not at first, but eventually he is, especially after emancipation, especially after his three meetings with Abraham Lincoln. It was almost a fourth. And Douglas becomes, by the end of the Civil War, and certainly in the early years of Reconstruction, that fascinating example. At least I made this a major theme of my book. He is the old radical outsider who becomes a kind of political insider. Mm-hmm. And that's a journey that we've seen other times in American history. Look at all the leaders of the modern civil rights movement who then got elected to office as mayors and as congressmen. And then there was this young guy named Obama who actually got elected president, for God's sake. You know, what happens when you're inside of power? What deals do you have to make? What compromises do you have to make about principle? Douglas lives that story as kind of the prototype of that for the rest of American history. But he had tremendous political instincts. It took time to develop it. But he had an astute understanding of politics as power and finding ways to wield it and to bend it. His frustration was always, of course, that abolitionists had so little power. They were always on the outside knocking on the doors to get inside. But even when he got inside, to some degree, with Republicans during Reconstruction and in the wake of Reconstruction, and then when he even got three federal appointments, one as Marshal of the District of Columbia, another as Recorder of Deeds for the District of Columbia, and third as U.S. Minister to Haiti in 1889. He had relationships with every Republican president.
I want to talk about those presidents. Let's dive into that. Let's start with Lincoln. In a chapter titled The Kindling Spirit of His Battle Cry, we learn about Douglas and Lincoln, a relationship you describe as difficult but eventually historic. How did they view one another initially?
Well, at arm's length, at least. In fact, Douglas was a ferocious critic of Lincoln in the first year, even year and a half of the Civil War, until Lincoln finally came out publicly for emancipation with the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation in September of 1862. Douglas's struggle the first year of the Civil War was whether to trust the Republicans, whether they really were as anti-slavery as they seemed to portray themselves. That relationship, though, took hold, particularly in 1863 with their first meeting. August of 63, they meet in Washington, but that was at Douglas's demand. He didn't have any invitation. He went, in effect, to protest discriminations against black soldiers in the army. They had, as they say in diplomatic circles, they had a useful exchange of ideas. They didn't entirely agree, but Douglas did tell us after that first meeting with Lincoln at the White House in 63 that he was impressed with Lincoln as a person. I think he was awed by Lincoln, because Lincoln at least took him seriously, sat and talked with him. In fact, Douglas walked away from there and wrote that he'd never been treated so straightforwardly and honestly by a white man with power as he had been by Lincoln. Their second meeting, though, is the great one. It's a full year later. It's August of 64. The war is in a horrible stalemate. Lincoln believes he may not be reelected in the election of 1864, and with good reason. The Democrats are just pummeling the Republicans as the party of emancipation and doing pretty well at it. Lincoln invites Douglas as the, principal spokesman of Black America to the White House. They have probably a full hour meeting, at which Lincoln asked Douglas, looked him in the eye, and wanted him to be the chief agent of a scheme that would funnel as many slaves as possible out of the Upper South into Union lines and into the Northern states and into some version of legal freedom before Election Day, in case Lincoln wasn't reelected. And Douglas, I'm convinced, sat there and probably looked back at Lincoln and just was speechless. Probably didn't know what to say. He was being asked to organize some kind of John Brown-style system to funnel slaves out of the South. Douglas didn't have a clue how he was supposed to do that. All he was told was, the War Department and the Army will help you. He goes back to Rochester, and for almost 2 weeks, he starts sending letters and telegrams to his friends and abolitionists and people who'd been recruiters of black troops, and here's what we're going to do. I don't know how, but here's what we're going to do. But he was saved. None of this ever happened because of what happened on the ground in the war. Atlanta fell to Sherman first week of September. Even before that, Mobile Bay fell to Admiral Farragut August 25th. Phil Sheridan's army began to move down the Shenandoah Valley right in the beginning of September, and the war changed, and Northern morale changed for the better, and Lincoln's reelection by September and into October looked much, much more likely. The last time they will meet is, of course, right after the second inaugural address. Douglas was in the crowd. Douglas went to Washington. He was going to be there. He was off to Lincoln's left, down in the crowd. And after the speech, which Douglas thought was fantastic, he went on to Pennsylvania Avenue and he just walked all the way to the White House following the presidential carriage. He didn't have an invitation, but he just got in line. He put through his card. He said, I'd like to come into the reception. And they said, no, sir, you can't. And Douglas tells us that he said, well, tell President Lincoln that Frederick Douglass is out here. 2 minutes later, the police came back out and said, yeah, come on in. Hmm. And in the East Room, in a big reception, they spy each other. Lincoln comes over to Douglas. And according to Douglass's recollection, Lincoln asked Douglass what he thought of the speech. This is the great second inaugural. Every drop of blood shed by the lash shall be paid with blood shed by the sword, and so on. And Douglas tells us that he told the president, no, sir, it doesn't matter what I think. Attend to all of your guests. And Lincoln said to Douglas, no. I want to know what you think. And Douglas tells us, he said, Mr. President, that was a sacred effort. Now, that's a very good description of that speech. It's a very biblical speech. It's a very Old Testament speech. And then, of course, Lincoln was assassinated 1 month later, and or 5 weeks later. And the irony there is, well, there are many, but Lincoln had invited Douglas to come have tea in late March at the Soldiers' Home, which was this retreat where Lincoln and other presidents would go. And who knows, that might have been a much longer meeting. But Douglas had to turn it down because he had a speaking engagement and he couldn't go. And then Lincoln was killed, of course, April 14th, and he was gone. Now, but from that point on, Douglas will campaign for every Republican candidate for president the rest of his life. Grant, twice, Hayes, Garfield, and Harrison, and so on and so on. He became a stalwart of the Republican Party in the sense that he supported the Republican candidacies no matter who it was.
Can we talk about Andrew Johnson for just a moment?
Sure.
Douglas said of Johnson, whatever Andrew Johnson may be, he is no friend of our race. It's incredibly vivid in your book, a very public argument? I don't know. What should we call that? A very public back and forth between the two men. What came of this fight?
Well, it was a terrible exchange, wasn't it? It's in February 1866. It's in the midst of the struggle in Congress to try to come up with a Reconstruction plan. Douglas gets up a delegation of 12 black men, including his oldest son, Lewis. They got an appointment at the White House to meet with the president, Andrew Johnson. And they went with various pleas and ideas they wanted to discuss, especially the right to vote. But they never even got to speak, really. Johnson held forth and preached at them, in effect, for about 45 minutes. He told them, if it weren't for your people, this war wouldn't even exist. This can never be a country that's truly biracial. He even said things like, you know, I once owned some slaves, but, you know, I freed them. But even when I owned slaves, I was more their slave than they were of mine. And it got worse from there. And Douglas kept trying, as the leader of the delegation, this is at the White House. Douglas kept kind of raising his hand, and he would say, but Mr. President, may we, and Mr. President, and at one point Johnson said, be quiet, I'm not finished. And it just deteriorated from there. Here was a president of the United States spewing this racism at a delegation of 12 black men who come to talk to him about their futures. And as they were leaving the room, Douglas got the delegation to stand up. They just realized this isn't going anywhere. It's over. They're about to leave the room. And they all overheard Johnson say this because a member of the press. And by the way, the press was there recording this. Johnson was overheard to say, that Douglas, he's just like every other N-word. He'd sooner cut your throat than not. Now, I have always had this imagination. I don't know exactly what Douglas was thinking, but Douglas must have turned around and I'd have given anything to see his eyes meet Johnson's at that point. What we do know is they went back to a hotel. They wrote up a manifesto that was published the next day in a Washington, D.C. newspaper. And then Douglas went to his desk and he did what he always did. He wrote a new speech. He took it on the road for the next 6 months. And the title of that speech was The Perils of Our Republic. And he developed not just a critique of Andrew Johnson, he skewered Andrew Johnson as the great danger to the future of American democracy. And in that speech, he laid out a whole scheme that of measures that he believed should be done to thwart and stop Andrew Johnson. But that was their only significant encounter. And there's no question, Andrew Johnson was the worst possible thing that ever happened to the potential of the future of black rights. He was, above all, a virulent white supremacist.
My guest is David Blight. The name of the book is Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. As we mentioned, the Douglasses lived in Rochester. There was a terrible fire, loss of the home. Douglas had no doubt it was the work of the Klan. He leaves. He moves to D.C. He has various appointments under different presidents. One of them, he was a huge failure. He was president of the Freedmen's Savings and Trust Company, a savings and loan institution for blacks. Did not work out. He had to use about $10,000 of his own money as faith money to back up the bank. Under Hayes, he's appointed U.S. Marshal for the District of Columbia. How did living in D.C. and being a part of all this, being the insider, how did it change him, if it did?
Well, when Douglas and his entire extended family moved to Washington in 1872, he was coming to the center of power. And by the way, he already had come to Washington on and off. Two of his sons relocated there. They had opened a newspaper called the New National Era, and they ran that paper from 1870 to 71. In D.C., his sons actually were the printers. And Douglas was listed as the editor, but he didn't always do all the editing either. So he'd already had interest in D.C. before he formally moved there. But after that, Douglas becomes a fixture of Washington, D.C. political life as an African American. Now, this is during the Grant administrations, the two Grant administrations. Grant, indeed, had even appointed him as a secretary, not as a full member of the commission, but a secretary to the Santo Domingo Commission in 1871, which went down to Santo Domingo, what is now the Dominican Republic, to investigate the possibilities of the United States annexing Santo Domingo. Actually, it was a determined plan to annex Santo Domingo, and Douglas actually became an advocate of that. We must recognize that. Then later, when Hayes is elected, he is made Marshal of the District of Columbia. And by the way, in that role as Marshal, one of the Marshal was really like the Sheriff of the District of Columbia. settling disputes and so on. But he also had a ceremonial role. He escorted the president, the incoming president and the outgoing president at each inauguration. He frequently did events at the Capitol, at the White House. He was sort of inside of the circles of power now. And he began to make very close relationships with some Republican congresspeople. But mostly Douglas was still an orator, still traveling the circuit, talking about every issue that came before the country, and especially any issue that had to do with race, the rights of the freedmen, the future of the freedmen. But he is trying in every way he can now as this aging man, the aging Douglas by the 1870s and into the 80s, to influence power. Most often, he's not having much great influence. But one of the most fascinating things about this year of Douglas's life, and it actually in some ways took over the book for me, are all these relationships he makes. And some of them are relationships with other black leaders. And he develops these bitter rivalries mm-hmm. with several other black leaders, especially the next generation.
That was my conversation with David Blight about his biography, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, for our monthly series, Full Bio. Tomorrow, we wrap up the conversation with Douglass's later years, including his time as U.S. Minister to Haiti, plus the reaction to Douglass's death in 1895.